On this day in 1965, the Beatles' sixth studio album, Rubber Soul, was released. Music historian Bill Martin says that the release of Rubber Soul was a turning point for pop music in general, in that for the first time, the album, rather than the song, became the basic unit of artistic production. Other tracks include Michelle and If I Needed Someone, or Norwegian Wood. And this actually is my favourite song on Rubber Soul, but it's an extraordinary album. Rolling Stone ranked it fifth on the magazine's 2012 list of the greatest 500 albums of all time. What's your favourite Rubber Soul song? Text us 2101. Chris Wikaita, are you a Beatles fan at all?
Yeah, sort of a latent one perhaps. Haven't really listened to a lot in recent years. But working on, you know, community radio, you got to in the early 80s, mid 80s, you got to still play a lot of it. Yeah, and I think off that album, well, Norwegian Wood's probably the most well known, but Michelle, My Belle.
Isn't it amazing?
Probably my favourite track off that album.
Zina, ever went through a Beatles phase?
Before my time, I'm afraid.
Before your time, so that's a big
way
no.
Way before.
Yeah, that's what I can hear, right? Way before. All right, fair enough. But there you go. That is what I consider. It's certainly in my one of my top albums of all time on this day in 1965. Rubber Soul, that great album, was released. Katie says, long grass is better for biodiversity. I don't mow my lawn because I love the beachside fluffies. What does that mean? I have trouble stopping to do good neighbours spraying and mowing. Tell the nosy neighbour to F off. I'm all for long lawns and feeding bees. So bit of response on that. Zina Jalil, her first time on the panel, is with me, and Chris Wikaita on today's show. To this, with tension escalating between China and members of the Five Eyes Security Alliance, most recently over a Chinese tweet that used a doctored image to attack Australia, New Zealand is arguably in a prime position to broker a kind of truce, writes Professor Al Gillespie in The Conversation, who goes on to write that someone needs to take the initiative. Right now, things are deteriorating as the trade standoff with Australia demonstrates. Alexander Gillespie is Professor of Law at the University of Waikato, and he's with us now. Al, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Wallace.
Good afternoon. So the Five Eyes allies, we've got America, Britain, Canada, Australia and New Zealand. And of these nations, you say that it is New Zealand that could be in prime spot to be broker?
I think so. I think if you look at the other members of the Five Eyes, each one of them has a beef with China. We're the only one which has not got a specific issue, and that gives us a little bit more leverage to try to find a way through it.
How much do we stand to lose if we don't get this right? Because New Zealand and China, I mean, we do have a relationship now, right? Not least in trading?
Both sides are going to yell at us. One side's going to be yelling at us to say more, and the other side's going to be yelling at us to say less. And so what we have to do now is walk down a very fine middle path. I think there are some areas that we can do this in, but it will be a very difficult period in years ahead.
Right. So I'm just thinking, how might a broker work? Because you're actually in the article, you gave a very interesting historical precedent, right? So let's just say this. You cite Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev in 1985 going to neutral ground in Geneva. There's a meeting that no one thought would ever happen, and I'm sort of old enough to recall that. You cite that as some sort of model, if you like.
What I'm trying to do here is, like, look at the way that we got out of previous conflicts, and then obviously the big one was the Cold War. And you do that over a long period. Like, it takes at least a decade, sometimes longer. You start with an independent place where the people can come together and have a face-to-face meeting where they're not yelling at each other in the international media. I think New Zealand could be that place. We've got certain things that can bring us together. We could do a conservation initiative, and we could get the people, invite Biden, invite Xi, and start talking in private.
Okay, all right. Well, maybe Zina, putting a former New Zealand Trade Commissioner hat on, you might have some thoughts on this.
Yeah, I think, you know, China and the Five Eyes partners are all important relationships for New Zealand and mature relationships. But we've always had an independent foreign policy approach and one that is informed by our values. And one of those values is around us being a very peaceful people, a peaceful country and known internationally for that. We have a prime minister who's been in the running for the Nobel Peace Prize. And in the current environment, perhaps more than ever before, we are seen as a country that can be trusted, you know, a country with high integrity. So all good ingredients to play the role of peace broker.
Yeah.
If that's what we decide to do.
Al?
I think it's what we've got to do. I think we need to get... Well, I'm not saying that we can draft the agreement, but I'm saying that we can be the ground where we can bring the opposing sides together and start a new type of relationship. Because at the moment, pretty much almost every day, there's something that's pointing in the wrong direction, whether it's over human rights, whether it's over war crimes in Afghanistan, whether it's over trade. We've seen a lot of increased antagonism between the different sides, and New Zealand increasingly is getting pulled into picking one side or the other.
Mm. Well, Prime Minister Ardern has invited Joe Biden to New Zealand. Should she do the same for Xi Jinping?
That's what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting you could invite both.
Yeah, yeah. What do you reckon, Chris? I mean, wouldn't that be a coup if Aotearoa were able to get China and the US around a table in Wellington, or maybe sort of pick a a place up north, so say Russell, that wonderful pub on the beachside.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly think that, you know, our reputation on the international stage is such that we have the ability to do it. And there are a few other places, as was mentioned, particularly in with the other four of the Five Eyes partners, where everyone's got beef, and China's just successfully goaded Australia into a much angrier position in recent times. Over that cartoon, and yeah, played them a merry dance from what I can see. Yeah, it's worth a try, absolutely worth a try. Mm-hmm. And the benefits for us as a tiny little nation at the bottom of the world could be huge. As could on the other side of the coin, the damage to us as a tiny little nation at the bottom of
right.
the world, if this it gets worse, could be huge.
Yeah. So this is actually feasible. We should actually kind of promote this, Al, some sort of brokerage between the US and China. We could do it.
I think that's the big goal here, but I think you need to start off with a small step. And historically, the way that would work is you'd get countries together and do like a conservation initiative or something that they both shared. And in the case of New Zealand, America, China and Australia, we all share one bird, which is the godwit.
Oh, okay.
We could come together and we could start talking about the conservation of the bird as a stepping stone towards resolving much greater difficulties, the much bigger political difficulties that will take years to resolve.
Mm. Where does the US fit into all of this now? I mean, we'll be wanting to maintain relations with the new administration, won't we, Joe Biden's administration, which I believe they're going to continue tariffs against China, at least for the foreseeable future.
Not only that, Biden is, I think, going to be more hawkish than Trump on this. In the weekend, China put on more retaliations against America with restrictions over artificial intelligence and trade. And so you've got seeing China already starting to amp it up again with the next level of the possible trade war with America.
Mm. All right, interesting. Al Gillespie there, Professor of Law at the University of Waikato. And Tony in Wellington says, my favourite song from Rubber Soul is In My Life, the hands down the best song and a beautiful love song sung to me by my wife on our wedding day. Isn't that wonderful?
That's so sweet.
Yeah. Thanks for your text, Tony. 2101 is the way to get in touch with us here, or you can email the panel at rnz.co.nz. Well, to this, humanity is waging war on nature. This is suicidal. Nature always strikes back, and doing so with force and with fury. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres did not mince his words. He went on to list a litany of human-inflicted wounds, a million species at risk of extinction, dying coral reefs, air pollution killing 9 million a year, reports The Guardian's environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. With us is Associate Professor Ralph Chapman, who is at the School of Geography, Environmental and Earth Science at Victoria University Wellington. Ralph, kia ora.
Kia ora, Wallace, how are you?
I'm very well. You would not get much starker than those words. Actually, quite an extraordinary speech, really. I mean, putting aside all the politeness and all diplomacy, but I guess, is this what is now needed?
I think it is, really, frankly. And, you know, we had the climate emergency declared in New Zealand yesterday in Parliament. And, you know, we've got a string of warnings from eminent people like Guterres over the last few years, and they've been ramping up because the, you know, the combination of things like biodiversity loss and climate change has become more and more worrying, and you know, people like Attenborough have sort of mixed into that that call and really said, you know, the collapse of civilization is on the horizon. And you know, I'm beginning to think, and I've been working on these issues for 30 years, but I'm beginning to think with the way the climate is going at the moment, that, you know, human action is it's just not serious enough in dealing with the issues. So, you know, you can't discount those. It sounds very melodramatic, but, you know, I don't think we can discount those warnings. And, you know, if you think back to that special report, the IPCC, the, you know, the world's climate scientist body did in 2018, they said, look, you know, we've got a decade to cut our emissions in half globally, or we're going to shoot way past this 1.5 degree warming limit. It's a sort of threshold, really. And once you go beyond 1.5 and, you know, you're up around 2 or more degrees of warming, then all bets are off. You know, we've got just so many possible feedback systems that can kick in at that point. And a lot of those are very scary, like the release of, you know, methane from the tundra and so on. So, it all adds up to a quite a bleak picture. And I was reminded, I went to a Peter Barrett symposium about a week ago. He's one of our eminent climatologists and Antarctic scientists and geologists by training. And getting on for 20 years ago, he said, look, if we end up with 3 degrees of warming, that'll be the collapse of civilization. And that's where we're heading. Did you realize that the pledges of different governments around the Paris Agreement add up to about 3 degrees of warming? So that's what governments have
pledged
to take us to.
Right. Well, it's funny. You compare it to another sort of emergency, of course, Rafe, the pandemic, and it seems that we have a vaccine for that. We don't know how it'll pan out, but we it's almost like we need some sort of vaccine for climate change. I mean, it just seems so insurmountable, a problem of enormous proportions. It can feel a little daunting to the ordinary person.
Yes, that's very true, and yet it's not fundamentally, you know, something that we have to put up with. It's not inevitable, and I think there is hope.
Right.
But it won't come down to a simple fix like a vaccine. I mean, you can't take most of the world's cars off the road with a vaccine. And that's the sort of measure. It's interesting to see, for example, in the UK, they've recently said by 2030 there'll be no new petrol and diesel cars for sale. That's 9 years away. That's pretty radical stuff. And that's Boris Johnson, a Conservative Prime Minister, announcing that. And, you know, frankly, that's the sort of action that all developed countries should be taking now.
All right, let's go to our panellist, Zina. What are you got for a question for Rafe?
A comment, really.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in Fiji, like I was telling you earlier, and the impact of climate change is very real for the people there. It's not a hypothetical anymore. So strong words are great and pledges are good. But they need to be backed by action, right? And you mentioned the pandemic. I mean, with all the recovery efforts around COVID-19, we have actually got an opportunity to build back better, and that can drive some change. We also, I mean, you'd like to think that people do things because it's the right thing to do, but sometimes they need financial incentives to do it. And we're starting to see that, you know, investors are realizing that the sooner they move to a green and digital economy, the better it is for them and their assets as well as for their clients. So those are some things that we're starting to see. And I think also the younger generation now is less accepting of this and more vocal about it.
Rafe?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I think you know, Jacinda Ardern and her government is, you know, they're across the issue. And, you know, they have done certain things already, you know, some of which are controversial, like banning new offshore oil and gas exploration. But they've also done a number of things. You know, they've been supporting agricultural research and, you know, to try and reduce methane and nitrous oxide. They're building houses in more compact urban form and so on. And, you know, they're trying to decarbonize the public transport fleet. Well, a bunch of things. But my concern is that even they will recognize that that's not enough, and that there has to be a cranking up of that policy package, you know, to do things like rethink transport in a big way in the city. So, you know, we don't just go for more EVs and electric vehicles and invest, you know, we have to do things like investing in e-bikes and e-buses and cycle lanes and better footpaths and more compact housing development. And there's a bunch of connected things that will transform the way we get around our cities, and that's what's needed.
Chris Wikaida,
do we, yeah, I was just on that note, is there a risk that we affect society and those who are already the most vulnerable? Because things like EVs are expensive. Some of the things we're going to do to curb warming are going to be expensive. How do we protect those who already are struggling to you know, get by?
Well, you know, pick up on that EVs one. They are costly, and that's the point I'm making, in a way, that, you know, and this has come out in Britain. People have said, look, you know, banning petrol and diesel vehicles from 2030 is all very well, but what about poor people who have to get around, especially outside the city? And, you know, in the city, there are good alternative solutions, and they include things like e-buses and e-bikes and, you know, scooters and so on, and building more compact parts of cities. So, you know, the apartments and townhouses that are more centrally located, so you don't need to take a car everywhere, and also more working from home will help. So, you know, there's a series of connected, integrated, if you like, solutions that, you know, provide a way through, and maybe green hydrogen for, you know, people on the outskirts of cities, or, you know, people who have to move around the countryside and so on, farmers and so on. So yeah, there are solutions, and I think the government is probably very conscious of the, you know, the inequality aspect of it all, and, you know, trying to bring people along at the same time. But, you know, it shouldn't stop us trying to make those radical shifts, those transformations.
Right. Antonio Guterres said, look, unless the world cuts fossil fuel production by 6% every year between now and 2030, things will get much worse, much worse, he said, quoting him. In the 30 years you've been looking at this issue,
yeah,
do you remain an optimist, or do you actually go, I'm not so sure we can do it?
Is that better? Is that sound coming through now?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. 30 years, yes, I've been working on it for 30 years. And, you know, I have got more pessimistic, but I'm not out of hope. I think we still do have a possible future scenario, pathway forward. But it does now, because we've left action so late, it does involve more radical transformative action right across the board, not just, you know, farmers trying to reduce methane and nitrous oxide, but also people in cities transforming their transport system and rebuilding the shape of their cities and so on.
Mm.
Yeah, so that's, you know, quite radical stuff, really. And we've got to leave space in the atmosphere for those developing cities in Asia and so on. So, yeah, all it's right. It's quite a tricky combination.
Yes, indeed, isn't it? Great to have you on the program again. Associate Professor Rafe Chapman there from the School of Geography, Environmental and Earth Sciences, Victoria University of Wellington. Big, big issue. Zina, seemingly untractable, but I guess, hey, if we all do our bit over time, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't want to trivialise it, because it is a big issue and a very important issue, but if you think about how we adapted to COVID and the way we changed how we work and how we live and everything, what that just goes to show is that, you know, when push comes to shove and we have to change our behaviour.
Fair point.
We can do it.
Chris, how do you convince people that the scale is similar or the same, so that they respond in the same way? You know, COVID was something that might kill you. The climate change stuff, people don't make the same connection in their minds.
Yeah, and that's something that we really need to do to you know, to enable people to see the scale of devastation that's on its way, you know, for the world economy and for human life.
And as you say, people back home in Fiji, they're really living it, aren't they?
Yeah. Mm. You know, oceans, temperatures going up, sea level rising.
7 to 5, the panel are NZ National, Zaina Jalil and Chris Wikaita with me today on the panel. Now to a completely different story. An Australian farmer was killed by a giant tiger snake that wrapped around his body and bit him multiple times, the coroner has found. 78-year-old Winston William Fish was out working on his sheep farm in Hobart when he encountered the 1.4-metre snake, which bit him and coiled onto his arm and around his body. The coroner said his death from multiple organ failure was tragic, but it was a rare occurrence. Well, with us again on the program is Mark Paddy, a.k.a. the Snake Hunter. He's with us now. Mark, welcome again to the panel.
Thanks for having me back.
It's really nice to have you on, Mark, and we were actually going to have you on the program yesterday, but as it turned out, for you to talk about this tiger snake story, you were, as it happens, grappling for an hour with a tiger snake. Is that right?
That's correct. Essentially, I was holding up a washing machine while holding the tail end of a very large tiger snake that was in someone's house and trying to balance getting this tiger snake out, which was wrapped around quite tightly around the bottom of the washing machine, all while the phone was ringing and you were trying to call me. So, unfortunately, I wasn't able to take your call.
Gee, Wolf.
Priorities.
Constant ringing from our producer here. Meanwhile, you're grappling with a tiger snake. You should see Zaina's face. Wow. So back to you, Mark. How did it work out with the tiger snake in the end?
Yeah, I got the tiger snake. It was good, and everybody was safe. Unfortunately, at the same time, though, just before then, I was talking to somebody on the phone who was bitten by a snake. It was called a lowland copperhead that he got bitten by, and I was just trying to give him advice. Then I head to his house straight afterwards. I captured the snake and treated the man while he was waiting for the ambulance to arrive.
My goodness me. And just a reminder, some of these snakes are lethal, aren't they?
That's correct. All snakes in Melbourne, where I'm from, are venomous, and most of the snakes in Australia are actually venomous.
Let's just drop round the panel here. Zaina, have you much to do with snakes? Have you seen one?
Seen one when I was living in Singapore, actually.
Yeah.
But a very little one. Had never seen one before, but, I mean, I've just been very lucky to be living in a country where there are no snakes.
Yeah, so you'd really recoil at the sight of a large snake behind the curtain?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've just been thinking about Mark's experience from yesterday. I shouldn't really laugh. But the image that that Mark presented and you harassing him with your phone calls.
Yes, yes. Many apologies for that. What about you, Chris? Have you seen a snake?
No, I haven't. I love the fact that they're all on the other side of the ditch in Australia, mate.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, now, just in terms of the tiger snake, I mean, it is pretty tragic news here, of course. This man killed by a giant tiger snake. And the coroner did say it was a tragic, but it is a rare occurrence. So it is rare?
Look, it is very rare. While Australia's got the most deadly snakes in the world, and the tiger snake is the fifth most deadly snake in the world, they're generally very shy creatures. They don't want to fight you. They don't want to bite you unless they feel provoked in some way or they feel attacked. Now, I don't know the circumstance that led to the tiger snake biting the gentleman in Tasmania. I don't believe it was deliberately attacked in any way, and I'm not saying that, but a tiger snake can feel provoked, and when they feel provoked, that's when they bite.
Mm. And it sounds like he died from his bites, right? But the wrapping of around the body is just something, because obviously it was a very big one, nearly 1.5 metres. It's something that they do, right?
It's something that they can do, and this is the interesting thing. I've got pet tiger snakes at home. I spent my lifetime understanding tiger snakes. Usually when they bite, they'll bite quickly and then let go. When they bite and wrap on and hang on, it's usually when they want to eat something. So it's a very unusual circumstance to have a 1.5-metre tiger snake biting and hanging on to somebody at the same time. And from what I read of the news reports as well, the body was wrapped around his arm and his neck at the same time.
Because I thought you had snakes that were either constrictors or they were venomous snakes, but you're saying these do both.
Sometimes they do both. So I have some of the venomous snakes at home when I feed them. Sometimes they just bite and hang on. Sometimes they bite and hang on and then wrap around at the same time. Sometimes they just bite and let go and let the venom take effect. Often I've seen, when I've seen a tiger snake eat a blue-tongued lizard, for example, they bite and wrap around at the exact same time. So it's just something that they can do. Many people think, like you said, they either bite or wrap, but sometimes they can do both.
Mark, you take care, and again, we are sorry for calling you while you're grappling with a tiger snake.
No, you're welcome to call me anytime. My apologies for not being able to answer. Right. I thought my hands were tied.
Literally, Zina Jalil and Chris Weekiner, thank you very much for being with me today.
Sure was.
Thank you.
I'm Wallace Chapman. See you tomorrow for Friday's show. Amy Adams and Sam Johnson on the show tomorrow.